the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, August 15. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a mostly cloudy day. Winds will be from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Cedar Rapids and Iowa City both will see a high of 77, falling to a low this evening in Cedar Rapids of 59 and 61 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 8:07 p.m., sunrise tomorrow morning at 6:16 a.m., for a total daylight period of 13 hours and 52 minutes. From today's front page, back to normal, University of Iowa student move-in begins, a story by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette staff. Dorm life, which like everything else, experienced major disruption in the last 2 years, appeared largely back to normal Sunday on the University of Iowa campus when students ushered in the annual return to campus ritual with the start of residence hall move-in. From Sunday through Tuesday, University of Iowa's newest Hawkeyes will move in to one of the 11 residence halls at a designated time they chose through an online sign-up system. A slimmer sect of students was allowed to move in early Saturday for a fee, and returning students and others will move in later in the week. Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa also are moving in the majority of their students this week, welcoming new students Tuesday and Wednesday. Where the campuses last fall acknowledged the pandemic throughout their move-in and return to campus guidance, this fall's messaging looks largely pre-COVID-19, especially given revised guidance last week from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that lifted quarantine requirements and school-related testing mandates. I think a lot of people have done what they feel is necessary to feel safe, and now we get to open back up, new University of Iowa freshman Brendan Steinbach, age 18, from Mankato, Minnesota, told the Gazette on Sunday afternoon while unloading a mini fridge from the back of his vehicle outside Slater Residence Hall. With COVID-19 comfort levels raising and in-person classes making up the majority of fall semester course offerings, the University of Iowa is projecting a larger first-year class than its last two, and where its residence hall occupancy fell in the 2020-2021 school year from 5,218 from 6,333 the year before, staying sub 6,000 last year at 5,642, University of Iowa officials expect to once again top 6,000 this year. We are currently expecting well over 6,000 first-year and returning students to live in the residence halls in the 2022-2023 academic year, University of Iowa spokesman Steve Schmedeke said. The university in July thought the strong freshman class would require some to live a while in converted residence hall lounges, but Schmedeke last week told the Gazette that UI Housing and Dining has found room accommodations for everyone. We're expecting no students to be moving into temporary expanded housing, he said. The university did, however, reopen a residence hall it recently closed and pegged for possible demolition. Park Lawn Hall, built in 1955, along North Riverside Drive and near Hancher Auditorium. That building, featuring suite-style rooms with kitchens and bathrooms, this fall will hold 137 students, up from the 98 it housed 5 years ago. Iowa State University, which has 22 residence halls and student apartment buildings before the pandemic, reported occupancy nearing 10,500. COVID-19 drove those numbers into the 8,000s. But waning pandemic concerns has projections rebounding back to 9,700, according to ISU spokeswoman Angie Hunt. UNI, which houses a large chunk of its student body on campus, said residential numbers are still fluid for fall enrollment. Although officials prepared a fiscal 2023 2023 budget based on 2,997 in residence halls, according to State Board of Regents documents. That would be down from last fall, aligning with lower tuition revenue expectations for this year based on its projected enrollment. ISU and UNI anticipate occupancy rates steadily rising in the coming years, while UI anticipates holding steady at about 92% of its 6,569 total capacity. Last year, prominent on University of Iowa Housing and Dining's website was a fall 2021 link outlining, among other things, pandemic-related accommodations, including vaccine and face mask guidance. While neither were required, vaccination was strongly encouraged. We encourage all students to talk with their roommate about personal plans to manage COVID-19 and understand that it is up to each individual if they choose to disclose their vaccination status to a roommate, according to last year's UI guidance. Any communication that may be perceived to pressure, force, or coerce anyone to obtain a COVID-19 vaccination should be avoided. On-campus COVID-19 quarantine housing also was available for students last year, but this summer, a message to campus reported only limited space available in the Iowa House Hotel for students wishing to isolate or quarantine due to COVID-19. As with any illness, we encourage students to have a plan if they or their roommate becomes sick, according to the summer communication. Students may choose to return home or find alternate housing off campus in the event that they or their roommate needs to isolate or quarantine. This year's move-in guidance does include some reference to the pandemic, like in the UI list for what to bring that starts with a face covering and a thermometer. But UI freshman Gwen Campbell, age 18 of West Des Moines, on Sunday said her college experience in its infancy seems pretty typical. That's what she wanted and what she expected, even as her peers a year or and 2 years senior were restricted from meeting and mingling in person. I thought by the time I got to college, everything would be kind of back to normal, she said, while helping her family wheel in carts of belongings to her new dorm room. So I wasn't nervous. Also from today's front page, a story by Grace King of the Gazette staff, datelined Iowa City, entitled New Hills Elementary School to be built later than expected. The school board okays a timeline for a decade of projects. After months of debate that delayed the construction of a new elementary school in Hills by a year, the Iowa City School Board has agreed to move forward with the plan. The school board approved a facility master plan earlier this year that included construction of a new elementary school in Hills to replace the 50-year-old building. While the school originally was supposed to be completed by summer 2025, debate among board members as to whether the district should maintain a school in the community delayed construction for a year until 2026. Maka Pilcher-Hayek, who was elected to the Iowa City School Board in November, questioned the board's earlier decision to build a new school in Hills, noting that the number of students bused to Hills Elementary outweighs the number of students in residence. Our job is not to represent a town. It is to represent the best interest of all students, Pilcher-Hayek said at a board meeting. The board approved a timeline for its second round of facility master plan projects on April 14, which was described as a living document that could be modified and amended as needed, according to board documents. Last Tuesday, the board approved in a 6-1 vote a modified completion date for Hills Elementary in the timeline. Pilcher-Hayek voted no, saying she wanted more information on what growth in the community south of Iowa City might look like. The board approved a design contract earlier this year for an elementary school in Hills for $20.1 million, but is unsure where the school would be built. Options include the 7 acres of property where Hills Elementary currently sits or somewhere else in the city. For 2021-2022 school year, 70% of Hills Elementary students were bused to the school from areas north of Hills, the southern portion of Iowa City, and unincorporated parts of Johnson County. Hills Elementary has 139 students and 44 employees, the smallest enrollment of the district's elementary schools. The student body is 30% English language learners, whose first language is not English. Hills Elementary was named a National Blue Ribbon School for 2021 in the state school year, one of five in the state. The program recognizes public and private schools based on their overall academic excellence or progress in closing achievement gaps among students. School board members discussed the possibility of making Hills Elementary a destination school by adding programs such as dual language, magnet, or even year-round programming. Students outside Hills Elementary school boundaries would be allowed to attend the school through a lottery system, opening it up to kids who voluntarily want to make the journey because their parents want to take advantage of unique programming, school board member Lisa Williams said. In a letter to the school board, Deputy Superintendent Chase Ramey wrote that while closing Hills Elementary could potentially result in short-term financial gain, it is not overall fiscally responsible to close it. Ramey said officials anticipate housing growth in the southern part of Iowa City and Hills over the next 15 years. Hills is one of only three district schools south of Highway 6 and the only school outside the southern limits of Iowa City, Ramey said. Failing to maintain a presence in Hills will require redistricting that pushes students further north and reduces the number of schools available in the southern part of the school district. Hills Mayor Tim Kemp said the elementary school, which has been in the community since the 1960s, is vital. Residents were asked to approve two measures last November that will extend the Iowa City School District's physical plant and equipment levy to 2035 and a 1% local option sales tax to 2051. I think voters felt like a new school in Hills was going to be part of it, Kemp said. Renewing the levies provides funding for the facilities master plan that includes dozens of projects such as additions to schools, technology upgrades, and possible purchase of property. A new elementary school in Hills was recommended to be built and the initiative published in documents distributed to the community before the public votes in November 2021. This is what the community thought they were voting for, school board member J.P. Clausen said. I would anticipate if you have a very nice school in Hills, there will be growth down there. Hills has grown 30% in the last decade, with a population of 870, according to the 2020 census data. The district's shift to a middle school model by fall 2024 would further reduce the student population at Hills Elementary. The school board voted earlier this year to move sixth graders out of elementary schools and put them in the same building with seventh and eighth graders. To make this happen, the district is investing $34 million in its three junior high schools to fit an additional 400 sixth graders in each building. This also creates additional room for growth in the district's elementary schools. School districts like Cedar Rapids have grade levels similarly organized, with elementary schools housing K through 5th, middle schools 6th through 8th, and high schools 9th through 12th. Still others like Linmar organize students into intermediate schools of 5th and 6th graders. college community, for example, will eventually move ninth graders into their own building. Hills Elementary is one of more than 15 projects the Iowa City Community School District has on the horizon. A former elementary school called Old Hoover was demolished over the summer to create more parking and new tennis courts at Iowa City High School at 1900 Morningside Drive. The project budget is $2.35 million, according to board documents. Designing a new student commons, media center, music room, secure entrance, and adding a new heating, ventilation, and an air conditioning system to West High School at 2901 Melrose Avenue will begin this year with a budget of $7.25 million, according to board documents. Coralville Elementary School at 501 6th Street is in a project design phase with construction scheduled to begin this winter for a new secure entrance and elevator. Weber Elementary School at 3850 Rarit Road in Iowa City is scheduled to begin construction on a new secure entrance by the end of the year. And Garner Elementary School at 80 Birch Street in North Liberty is in a project design phase to expand administrative offices and the school's cafeteria, with construction slated to begin in fall 2023. Also from today's front page, Linn County Jail overtime spurs deputy complaints and resignations, a story by Emily Anderson of the Gazette staff from Cedar Rapids. The Linn County Correctional Center has adjusted its agreement for housing federal inmates in an effort to address deputy complaints and resignations about overtime work at the jail. Linn County Sheriff Brian Gardner said that because the jail has been short-staffed, deputies have been required to work overtime to meet the minimum number of corrections officers required for each shift. The number of officers needed each day depends on the number of inmates. They've been complaining about that overtime that they've been required to work. In fact, we've lost some deputies, very good deputies, to other agencies because of the amount of overtime that we're requiring them to work, Gardner said. Jail employees cannot be scheduled for more than 16 hours, excluding mandatory training or meetings, in a 24-hour period. They are paid time and a half for any work that exceeds 40 hours per week, according to the contract between the county and the local public professional and maintenance employees union. The jail didn't exceed its overtime budget for fiscal 2022. Of the $600,000 that was budgeted for overtime, Gardner reported $535,146 was spent. The bigger issue has been resignations. There currently are 50 sheriff's deputies and 7 female civilian correctional officers assigned to the jail. Female civilian officers meet the requirement that the jail have at least one jail-certified female staff member in the building when there are female inmates. Because there are fewer female deputies than male, there isn't always a female deputy working at the jail. Female civilian correctional officers have the same authority in the jail as deputies, but are not certified peace officers and do not have arrest powers. Since the beginning of the year, the sheriff's office has lost 4 deputies and 2 civilian female officers. It's hired 2 new deputies and 3 new civilian female officers. Gardner said there are still 5 deputy sheriff positions currently open, with a few job offers outstanding. Gardner said it's been difficult to fill open positions. The sheriff's office used to offer deputy sheriff testing once or twice a year, based on the numbers in the applicant pool, but now the office is testing about every 3 months. One cause for the overtime has been requirements for the federal inmates held there, which usually constitute 1/4 to 1/3 of the jail's total population. As part of the jail's contract with the U.S. Marshals Service and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, 2 deputies are required to accompany federal inmates when they leave the jail for things like a doctor's appointment or go to the hospital. If an inmate is taken to the hospital and admitted, that's 2 deputies per shift per day. So you're looking at 6 deputies per day. And if you have multiple people at the hospital, it exacerbates the problem, Gardner said. To address the problem, Gardner reached a new agreement with the U.S. Marshals and ICE. Federal agencies will be required to transport their detainees to and from scheduled medical appointments. They also will take over the responsibility of guarding federal detainees within 10 hours of them being admitted to the hospital. The changes fall within the parameters of the current contract between the jail and the federal agencies, which states that the local government agrees to provide transportation for federal inmates subject to the availability of its personnel. The federal government pays Linn County $86 per inmate per day to house federal inmates. It also pays $43 per hour for time spent by Linn County deputies transporting and guarding federal inmates outside the jail. The Linn County Correctional Center isn't the only jail dealing with overtime. Johnson County Sheriff Brad Kunkel said deputies in the Johnson County Jail also have been working overtime, but it's not due to staffing shortages. Kunkel said the jail is down only one deputy sheriff and is working to fill that position. There are, however, other factors, including deputies attending the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. Vacation requests, illness, training, military leave, and those at the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy all affect overtime availability, Kunkel said. We're definitely not having the staffing problems like other agencies who are down a lot of people. Turning to today's Insight page, we have a guest column by Alice Dahle, D-A-H-L-E, who lives in Iowa City. Her column is entitled, Abortion Rights Are Human Rights. Americans have long considered our country a model of freedom and human rights for countries around the world. But for at least half of the population, with the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court, that is no longer true. At a time when countries as diverse as Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Ireland, Mexico, South Korea, and Thailand have either decriminalized abortion or loosened restrictions on access, the United States is out of step and moving in the wrong direction. On the basis of a literal originalist interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, the Supreme Court has ruled that because abortion is not mentioned in the document, the right to access the procedure cannot be protected at the federal level. Using the same logic, women are not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution either. Does that mean that the rights of American women are not federally protected and can be determined by individual states? As a state party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the U.S. has a binding obligation under international human rights law to protect the rights of women to life, health, equality, non-discrimination, privacy, freedom from torture and cruel and inhuman treatment, and freedom from gender-based violence. In overturning the nearly 50-year precedent of women's rights to make autonomous decisions about their own bodies, reproductive choices, and futures, the court has violated the legal commitment to protect the right of women in the U.S. to enjoy the full spectrum of their human rights. Human rights are universal. They belong equally to all of us. If access to a full range of reproductive health care is left to each state to determine, women and others who can become pregnant will not enjoy the same right to freely make well-informed decisions that will affect the entire future of their personal and family lives. Instead, these rights will be constrained by the geographic and political environment of the state where they live. Restrictions on access to reproductive health care will most significantly limit the options of those who are already disadvantaged, including Black, Brown, and Indigenous women, migrant women, and those living with disabilities and victims of sexual violence and sex trafficking. We cannot allow this to happen. Fortunately, steps can be taken to reclaim and defend our rights to sexual and reproductive autonomy. We can pass the Equal Rights Amendment to put women unambiguously into the U.S. Constitution. This would prevent a strict interpretation from excluding women from protection of their rights under the law. It would also provide uniform protection for women living anywhere in the United States without local restrictions in their states of residence. The United States should ratify the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the only international treaty that sets an international standard for and comprehensively protects women's human rights, including sexual and reproductive health rights. The U.S. signed this treaty in 1980, but is now one of only seven countries in the world that has not yet ratified it. Congress could codify the right to safe and legal abortion services at the federal level. As a first step, Congress should pass the Abortion is Healthcare Everywhere Act of 2021. It is currently in the House of Representatives as H.R. 1670 and in the Senate as Senate Bill 4641. We must vote for legislators, both at the state and federal levels, who will protect the rights and dignity of women, girls, and others who can become pregnant. We can learn from the consequences of restrictive laws and bans on access to abortion in countries around the world. When abortion is banned, restricted, or criminalized, women who suffer miscarriages or stillbirths spend decades in prison. Doctors and other medical personnel are afraid to help with obstetric emergencies for fear or prosecution, and women die without medical help or as a result of unsafe abortions. Banning or restricting access to abortion does not end abortions. It only makes abortion unsafe. Reproductive rights, including the right to access abortion, are grounded in internationally recognized human rights. We must reclaim and defend these rights for women, girls, and those who can become pregnant both here in the U.S. and abroad. If we allow the loss of dignity, bodily autonomy, and the right to make one's own personal decisions in this country, authoritarian governments around the world will be emboldened to impose control over the lives and bodies of people living under their jurisdictions. It's time for the U.S. to again take the lead as a globally recognized defender of human rights. At peace by Alice Dolly of Iowa City. And we have two letters to the editor today. The first one coming from Jeff Klinsman of Coralville. His letter is entitled, Linmar Parents in Lawsuit Are the Real Bullies. Every right-wing accusation is really a confession. The latest example is the lawsuit filed by Linmar parents protesting the district's policy toward LGBTQ kids. The plaintiffs demand anonymity because they claim to fear being bullied. The plaintiffs are the ones who bully. It is bullying to misgender and deadname non-binary and trans people. Doing so dismisses as invalid LGBTQ identities. Such behavior is selfish and callous. Arguing one has religious reasons for such conduct reveals a faith as fake as Donald Trump's. Was this lawsuit a project of the private meeting between Kim Reynolds and those parents? Did Reynolds refer them to Alan Ostergren, plaintiff's counsel, because he has also represented Reynolds' administration? What role was played by Linmar board member Matt Rollinger, who attended that meeting and is named as a defendant? I ask Rollinger, will your role as a defendant be to leak defense strategy to the plaintiffs? Cracker Barrel restaurant recently enraged some people by offering a new menu item, vegetarian sausage. Some people expressed outrage at a menu choice they will never have to eat. The anti-LGBTQ Linmar parents are cut from the same cloth. They can't stand kids who choose not to live as they do. They view their own kids as property they control. Those parents need to look in a mirror and ask themselves, do my kids feel safe enough in our home to come out as LGBTQ? If they answer no, they are not supportive parents. That letter by Jeff Klinsman of Coralville. And the last letter comes from Patrick DePalma of Cedar Rapids. His letter is entitled, Slow Walking Stump Removal. It's now been 2 years since the derecho. Millions have been poured to help with the replanting effort, including an additional $2.8 million as reported in Wednesday's Gazette. What seems to have been forgotten is the removal of stumps in the right-of-way. The city quickly removed thousands of trees deemed too damaged to survive and acknowledges that it is its responsibility to remove the stumps, even setting up a dashboard on its website to track progress. The website states that the effort is expected to run through summer 2023. 2 years after the derecho, only four of 64 zones are completed. Each time I've contacted the forestry department, I'm given no specific information aside from what's on the dashboard and told that they'll waive the permit fee if I pay to have the grinding done privately. Marion hired a private contractor. Cedar Rapids seems to have adopted the tactic of going slow to encourage homeowners to do it themselves. No one seems concerned that the summer of 2023, it is an unrealistic estimate, and that actual progress would put this project on a 32-year path at two zones per year. What will it take to get the city to make this process a priority? With millions of dollars flowing for derecho recovery, why aren't we allocating any of that funding toward stump removal? And that letter by Patrick DePalma of Cedar Rapids. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, August 15, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, Morgan Elizabeth Kelly Bloom, age 37, passed away in her home surrounded by her loving family on Friday, August 12, after a courageous 15-month battle with a rare and aggressive form of breast cancer. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday, August 15, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 16, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. Burial will be at 1:30 p.m. at the Immaculate Conception Cemetery in Castle Grove, Iowa. From Cedar Rapids, Kenneth, also known as Bear W. Stockfleet, passed away on Thursday, August 11, at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, August 17, at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. And from Cedar Rapids, Jody, also known as Joe Hoskins, age 63, passed away Thursday, August 4. Per his request, only a celebration of life will be held at a later date. From Wellman, Lauren Lee Bender, a celebration of life service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 15, at the Powell Funeral Home in Wellman, and a visitation will be from 9:30 a.m. until the service time. From North Liberty, Dewey Richard Hinkle, age 85, died peacefully on Saturday, August 13, surrounded by his family. Funeral services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Friday, August 19, at the Lensing Oak Hill Funeral Service at 210 Holiday Road in Coralville. A visitation will be from 12:30 p.m. to service time, and burial will be at the Ridgewood Cemetery in North Liberty. From Cedar Rapids, Kirsten Noel McClendon. A visitation will be at 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. with a memorial service at 11:30 a.m. She passed away suddenly on August 11 after a brief illness. And services will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Online Chapel. Online condolences are welcome under obituaries. From Cedar Rapids, Phyllis Marie Oliver, age 87, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on August the 12th. A private family service and burial has been planned. And from Cedar Rapids, Patricia Ann Till, age 73, formerly of Davenport, passed away on Saturday, August 13. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Arrangements are with the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. And from Cedar Rapids, Angeline, also known as Angie Teresa Ryan, age 90, passed away at her home surrounded by her family on Friday morning, August the 12th. A funeral mass will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday at the Papich Kuba Funeral Home East at 1228 2nd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Also from Cedar Rapids, Roe C. Zames, Jr., age 86, was called home to be with his Lord on August 9 at the age of 86. Services are Saturday, August 20 at 10 a.m. at the Grace Episcopal Church, and visitation will be Friday, August 19, 4 to 7 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Funeral Home, and burial will be in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Joanne Collins, age 72, passed away July 24 at the Heritage Care Facility in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of Joanne's life will be held on Sunday, September 11 at 11:30 a.m. at the Christ Episcopal Church at 220 40th Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. And from Marion, Harley L. Dallage, age 94, formerly from Tipton, passed away on Thursday, August 11, after a brief stay at the Hiawatha Care Center. Funeral services are Saturday, August 20, at the St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence. Visitation is from 9 to 10:30 a.m., with the service and burial to follow. Lunch will be served in the church fellowship hall. From Tipton, Alice Ann Gallagher, age 86, died peacefully surrounded by family on Sunday, August 14, at the Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. Graveside committal services will be at 2 p.m. Monday, August 22, at the Tipton Masonic Cemetery, where she will be buried with her husband and daughter. From Iowa City, Daniel R. Napierala, age 78, passed away unexpectedly on August the 10th at the Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. Services celebrating Dan's life will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Saturday, October 15, at the Gay and Shia Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, with sharing of remarks, memories, and toasting Dan's life to begin at 6 p.m. And from Van Horn, Chad Quentin Renkin passed away at home unexpectedly from unknown health complications on August 11. A public visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 16, at Lock at Tower Park Funeral Home at 4140 Kimball Avenue in Waterloo. A private family burial will take place in Oak Hill Cemetery in Parkersburg. From Williamsburg, David, also known as Pops Allen Cahalan, passed away on Friday, August the 12th, after a courageous battle with lung cancer. Visitation will take place from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, August 17, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A celebration of life will be held from noon to 5 p.m. Thursday, August 18, at the Red Cedar Lodge at Wanatee Park. From Shellsburg, Marion H. Schminke, age 90, passed away on Thursday, August 11, in a vehicle accident near Vinton. Memorial services will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, August 18, at the New Covenant Bible Church at 3090 North Center Point Road in Cedar Rapids. A private family interment will be held at Mount Pleasant Cemetery near Shellsburg prior to the service. And from Mesa, Arizona, Donald Eugene Gott, age 88, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away in Mesa, Arizona on July 14. A memorial service will be held in Mesa on September 16 at the Tempe Mortuary, and a second memorial service will be held later in the fall in Missouri. And in other death notices today from Atkins, Dana Toe, age 66, died Saturday, August 13. The Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is handling arrangements. From Decorah, Lee Holksevic, age 54, died Friday, August 12. The Helms Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. From Hopkinton, Helen, also known as Virginia Supple, age 95, died on Sunday, August 14. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Lisbon, Betty Ann Murta, age 86, died Sunday, August 14. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Luana, Lil Dale Sweet, age 77, died Friday, August 12. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. From Manchester, Dolores R. Probst, age 97, died Saturday, August 13. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester is assisting the family. And from Marion, Evelyn Teresa, also known as Terry Culberson, age 82, died Saturday, August 13. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family. And in other deaths, Janice Cashin, age 71, of Creighton, Nebraska, formerly of Independence, died on Friday, August 12. The Fawcett Schmitz Funeral Homes in Winthrop and Lamont is handling arrangements. From South English, Robert Leroy Bowman, age 83, died Friday, August 12. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is handling arrangements. Turning to today's sports page, we have an article by J.R. Ogden entitled, It's Football Season and Life is Good. This game makes our blood boil and yell at the screen, but we love it. Here we go again. It's the middle of August and already pretty much football, football, football. There's a little baseball mixed in right now. The Colonels are in the Midwest League playoffs, and there were a couple of little professional games in Dyersville last week that caught the attention of a few thousand people outside our borders. And volleyball on the high school and college levels will be cranking up soon, along with cross-country, golf, swimming, and soccer, to name a few. But in this day and age, football is king. High school on an ultra-local level, Iowa, Iowa State, and UNI on a more regional level, and NFL on every level. We as a society are obsessed with this violent game. It gets our blood boiling, makes us scream at our TV screens, and jump for joy from our couches. I can't even begin to explain or even understand why, but I'm no different. Football is my favorite spectator sport. Wrestling is right up there too, but nothing beats a Friday night in the stands or a Saturday or Sunday afternoon in front of a TV watching this game, unless you are in a stadium somewhere. Iowa State, UNI, and Iowa all held their media days in the last 2 weeks, relaying their 2022 hopes and dreams. Everybody is unbeaten right now, and everybody is looking at a successful season if they stay healthy and somebody somewhere steps up and fills some gaps. The Hawkeyes and the Cyclones do, indeed, look like bowl teams again, and the Panthers always will be FCS playoff contenders. They will frustrate you, and you'll question the decisions the coaches and even the players make, but you'll still cheer loudly when something goes right. The NFL already is playing games, and no matter how meaningless preseason games are, you'll be watching. The Bears are 1-0, baby. High school teams are in the same place. They started practice last Monday and are getting close to their first kickoff. August 25 and 26 is week one. Prep coaches are sending us their prospectus for the upcoming season, and they too are 0-0 and optimistic. Last year was a solid year, even with a 4-5 overall record. One coach wrote, "We expect our schedule to be just as difficult this year, but with expectations that we can turn around a few of those tough losses." Our team will not be short on talent. On defense, we bring back most of our starters, so we expect to make a huge stride in being a stronger, more fundamental, and tougher defense. Another coach whose team went 8-3 last year and made the playoffs noted his team needs, quote, "to mature and grow up fast with the schedule the IHSAA gave us to play," end quote. Maybe that's why we love football so much. We never know where or how the ball will bounce, how the new kid, recruit, or draft pick will perform, or how an injury or three will affect our team. There's always hope. Hope for another successful season. Hope for a remarkable turnaround. And the football coach is a rare breed. "It should be exciting," a veteran coach wrote in his questionnaire about his team's district. This coach, by the way, has been working with high school teams for more than 50 years. He's still going strong and still loving the game. "We must stay healthy," he wrote. "We must be able to run the football more consistently. It's football season. Let the games begin." Dear Abby today is entitled "Retired Man Ready to Travel While Wife Is Still Working." Dear Abby, "I'm 62 and recently retired. My wife is 56 and still working. We've been married 32 years. She will retire at 60 to get a full pension from her company, and we have several million dollars in our retirement savings. We travel together internationally once a year for about 10 days. I've talked to her about my desire to travel more often by myself or with my retired friends, since now is my golden age and I'm still physically able to do it. I enjoy classical operas, music, and would go to some music festivals, such as the Salzburg Festival. My wife thinks I'm selfish, since she still works. I've explained to her that we can't predict our future physical abilities. My knees are deteriorating. If, by the time she retires, I'm no longer physically strong enough to travel, I may regret it forever. If the situation were reversed, and she wanted to travel by herself or with her friends after she retired, I think it would be selfish of me to insist she not do it. Is she right? Signed, Pondering in Pennsylvania. Abby responds, "I don't think so. You have worked hard for many years to be able to afford the luxury, and you should be allowed to enjoy the benefits of your labors with her blessing. In a few more years, she will have the same freedom. I hope your health will allow you both to take many more vacations together in the future." Turning to today's community page, we have an article by Sabine Martin of the Gazette staff entitled "ISU and Deere," that's John Deere, "Program Prepares Apprentices for Workforce." An apprenticeship program run by Iowa State University professors and Deere & Company helps high school graduates enter Deere's workforce and improve their communication skills for future employment. The four-week speaking and writing course works with 50 students going into their senior year from 12 high schools and is held in Deere facilities in Davenport, Waterloo, and East Moline, Illinois. Apprentices work part-time during the school year and 35 hours a week in the summer. The program also added IGNITE, I-G-N-I-T-E, which stands for Introduction to Advanced Manufacturing, this year, which is aimed at students in 8th to 12th grades. IGNITE is run through Hawkeye Community College in John Deere's Waterloo Tech Works campus. Students learn about advanced manufacturing and get paid. David Ottavianelli, Deere's Director of Workforce and Community Development, said Waterloo was added to the program this year after seeing overwhelming interest the year before. This is, in addition, really to help enhance that candidate pipeline of high school students, to give them the skills and awareness to do this, he said. The program had 6 participants in its first year in 2019 and has grown to 50 apprentices. Students can focus on computer numerical control machining, welding, and software engineering in the apprenticeship. Emma Murray, an assistant teaching professor at ISU, is an instructor in the program. She teaches high-level courses in scientific and technical writing at the university. Student apprentices get to go on the floor and shadow Deere employees and do hands-on work within legal limits, she said. From there, if they've mastered their skills, completed the certification, and have the behavioral competencies like showing up on time and communicating with people appropriately, they could be offered a full-time job if they're 18, Murray said. 12 out of the 15 students from Davenport and East Moline, Illinois, were hired for full-time employment at Deere after their apprenticeship last year, she said. That was pretty cool, just to see that it was making a difference for them and their future career, she said. Apprentices participated in a pitch contest where they had to pitch the benefits of the program to Deere employees. That was one way to get them kind of comfortable in front of an audience, even though, you know, typically they would be just with a friend talking, Murray said. Then, that kind of set them up for their final formal presentation, where they share with those John Deere and Ignite stakeholders their experience working with the program. Working with employees has taught Murray new things too, like how important communication is, she said. It turns out from the interviews that I've done with a few of the engineers at John Deere, there's a lot of communication going on, from proposals to email writing to PowerPoint presentation building, she said. And also from the community page, we have several things to do today. The first one is a museum exhibit entitled Hoover Museum Exhibit on Russian Famine, entitled Deliverance, America and the Famine in Soviet Russia, 1921 to 1923, is open through December 31. It recounts Herbert Hoover's and the American Relief Administration's food and medical relief efforts during the Soviet famine of 1921 to 1922. This is from 9 to 5 p.m. at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum at 210 Parkside Drive in West Branch. The cost ranges from $5 to $10. And we have a film entitled Summer Kids Dream Family Film Series. And you can watch Scoob, S-C-O-O-B. It's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Marcus Cedar Rapids Cinema at 5340 Council Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is $3. And a Connection Recovery Support Group. This is a peer-led support group for any adult age 18 of age and older who are experiencing symptoms of a mental health condition. This goes from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the NAMI of Linn County at 610 2nd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free. And we have a health activity entitled Metta Yoga. Experience the healing powers of meditative yoga from the spiritual environment. Heather English offers gentle beginners yoga. It goes from 9:30 to 11:45 a.m. today at the Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center at 120 East Boyson Road in Hiawatha. The cost is $60 for a 6-punch card and $99 for an 11-punch card. And a hobby activity entitled Jigsaw Puzzle Exchange. If you dropped off a puzzle, pick up a new puzzle through August 20. It goes from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Hiawatha Public Library. That's at 150 West Wilman Street in Hiawatha. The cost is free. And a museum exhibit entitled Righting a Wrong, Japanese Americans and World War II. This exhibition from the Smithsonian examines the history and impact of Executive Order 9066, which led to the incarceration of 75,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry and 45,000 Japanese nationals following the attack on Pearl Harbor. It goes from 9:30 to 4 p.m. today at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library at 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest in Cedar Rapids, and the cost ranges from free to $10. We have one Eastern Iowa brief today. It comes from Mount Vernon, entitled An Array of Wonders, Exhibit Caps Cornell Career. More than 100 pieces of art created by Cornell College Professor of Art Anthony Plout during his 34-year career will be on display at Cornell's Peter Paul Luce Gallery in McWealthy Hall from September 9 to November 16. This exhibition, An Array of Wonders, Past, Present, and Future, includes many pieces produced during Plout's years of teaching. This solo exhibit will include drawings, paintings, sculptures, video, and mechanical contraptions. My art has changed a lot over the years in terms of media and theme, Plout said in a news release. But if there's a common element, it's that much of my work contains an aspect of mystery or apparent magic. I like art that seems to have come about in impossible ways. I want my audience to wonder about what it is that they're seeing. Plout, who retired last spring, will discuss his work during two public receptions at 4 p.m. at the Luce Gallery on the 9th of September from 3 to 5 p.m. and on October 21 from 3 to 5 p.m. During his time at Cornell, Plout taught photography, painting, drawing, collage, and assemblage. And that does it for the reading of today's Gazette for today, Monday, August 15. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.